but I'm happy to see how I can do with a few questions. Any questions? I won't promise to necessarily answer them. Do my best.
Thanks, David. Fantastic talk. Thank you. And really, you know, putting some things into order for me that really help. A couple of comments, really. One is, I read Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, some years ago. And in that, he says that for time to exist, light must exist. In other words, in a black hole where there is no light, there is no time. Time has stopped.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's fascinating that the Bible begins with God speaking creation into being by saying, let there be light.
Yeah.
Which I think is just an amazing
interesting, isn't it? Because historically, people have said, well, hang on a minute. The first day God says, let there be light. And on the fourth day, he says, let there be the sun.
Hmm.
And so historically, people questioned the order of the days because of that. No, it's interesting. I mean, at the conference, sorry to mention it again, the Geneva conference, one of the speakers was John Lennox, and he talked about that. He talked about the let there be light. Mm. I mean, I think, again, it's probably trying to read too much scientifically into the account. But nevertheless,
I just think it's a wonderful truth, isn't it, really, that you know, there's a scientific understanding and there's the word in the Bible. The other thing I was going to ask you was, if you take the reductionist point that you made, I guess there would be atheists who would say that our perception and our emotions and love and things are just kind of accidents of the chemistry and physics. And I've been reading quite a bit last year about consciousness and the issue about that science is really struggling to understand, come to a scientific understanding of how consciousness develops. So I guess my question was going to be, how do you talk to scientists who've come to the, or atheists, if you like, who've come to a conclusion that their whole kind of sense of being is just an accident of the physics and the chemistry?
I would say, first of all, recognize that there are lots of guys around who aren't Christian who are saying there is more to life than that. I mean, one of my favorites that I'll talk about after the break is Paul Davis. And Paul Davis is not a Christian, but he believes that just to say we're nothing but that it's too simple. There's something going on, is one of his phrases. There's something going on. I'm in the middle of reading a book by a philosopher, so I'm struggling with it a bit. But it's about the reductionist view for this philosopher who's not a theist in any way, saying the reductionist view is just too simple. It doesn't it can't help to comprehend mind and consciousness and all of that. He's looking not necessarily for a God answer to that, but actually a deeper level of understanding to it. So I think there's a lot of people around who find the reductionist stuff just too simple, and it doesn't do justice to the complexity of the universe we're in, which is where engaging with science is important, because we can actually use what others who are saying are not Christians to just challenge people who've got that reductionist sort of point of view. Yep.
So I find it really difficult, this whole thing, and I'm really fascinated. So I find it really difficult because I can't think of, for me, I can't believe that there's some kind of soupy chemical mix that came from a big bang could create all the diversity in nature, all the incredible detail consciousness, yes, it's a huge, isn't it? But also, you know, that insect that it's specifically designed for, that plant, and that the way everything is so perfectly balanced and so it's such a miracle, so finely detailed. Mm. How could that all come from one kind of soupy kind of mixture of chemicals?
Yeah.
Can't believe, although I could believe in things evolving to adapt to sort of climates and different changes. That's the thing, but I can't, that's the thing I can say, but I can't find any evidence. I can only pose that as a question in any discussion I'd have with anybody. I could only say, how could this be?
Yeah.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
But I can't give any evidence, so, which is maybe okay to sit with that, but I'm trying to say, is there anything to hang that on? All I can come up with in you know, is to say, look, you know, how could this be? Can you help me with that?
Yeah, I think it's again, Paul Davis talks about the amazing fruitfulness of the laws of nature, and we'll look at some of this after the break. This guy, Anthony Flew, who, when I was at Vickers School, He was the philosopher you had to read, the philosopher of religion you had to read, because he destroyed all the arguments for the existence of God. I mean, he was the most prominent atheist philosopher of his day. I came across this book a few years ago, and it's There Is No Crossed Out A God, How the World's Most Notorious Atheist Changed His Mind. And essentially, it was, for him, it was two things. The first was the idea of a Big Bang, so that it wasn't a universe without beginning or without end, that there was a start to it. That was important for him. But also, secondly, the stuff that we're going to look at after the break about the fine-tuning of the universe, he just did not believe that that could be just random, an accident. He thought there was more going on to it than that, and he says at the end he believes there is a God, although God hasn't found him yet. So for me, there are plenty of scientists out there who are wrestling with this. How come this amazing universe comes out of such simple, so apparently simple beginnings? Which is where Augustine's idea of seeds being, there being seeds of development within the initial creation. I love that idea, actually, that there is process that comes, you know, let the earth bring forth, and there is process that's built. So these days, the discussion about design is mainly about the design of the laws of nature rather than the individual details of what happens. So I think there are lots of people who think that the amazing fruitfulness of the simple laws of physics that we see around us there's something more wonderful going on. And Paul Davis will say, I haven't discovered it yet. But there is meaning and design and purpose, but we don't yet know what it is. So there are allies out there in the scientific community who share that view. No, this can't have just all happened by accident. So I think he's a good one to read, particularly a book called The Goldilocks Enigma, where you know the story of Goldilocks, guys. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. And there's lots of stuff in the universe that's not too hot, not too cold, but just right to produce us. And that's what that book is about. The Goldilocks Enigma. And he's writing from a non-Christian viewpoint, but there are others around who do write from Christian viewpoints on that stuff, but we'll look at that after the break. But yeah, I think it's the big question. The big question is, how can such a simple beginning lead to the complexity we have now? Davis says, how can featureless gases produce what's around us now? And you just think, no, there's something more going on.
Hi, I'm very much on the other side of the fence to the first two people who have spoken. I would desperately love to believe in God, but I'm still trying to find my way there. So in terms of how does a featureless void produce life, in my opinion, it couldn't do anything else. It will happen. As soon as you have replicating molecules, this will happen. It's inevitable.
So why are the laws like that?
I'm coming on to that. So, and Stephen said that, or Stuart, I beg your pardon, said that how do love and anger and joy and all of those things evolve? Those things are also inevitable. They're part of our survival machinery. We fall in love because there's no other way of ensuring sort of the reproduction of the species. It has to happen. It's extraordinarily useful. So the question that I want to pose, and we may or may not get anywhere in answering it, is that if you listen to people like Richard Feynman, my personal hero, very sadly deceased, absolutely wonderful guy, he says that it doesn't matter how your explanation, how beautiful it is. You know, it could be angels pushing the planets around for all we know, but angels pushing the planets around doesn't actually predict anything or explain anything useful. So you don't get anywhere by explaining what's happening. The only way you get anywhere is by predicting what's going to happen. So while I agree with you, it may be very unlikely that the universe, you know, the charge on an electron is such and the strong nuclear force is balanced to within a billionth of a percent, whatever it is. It doesn't actually help me understand to say that God did it. What does that predict for me? How does that make anything any clearer for me other than to say it was... I mean, because you could predict God, you could replace God with magic. Magic did it, or pixies did it, or you know, it just did. So how does that help me? But the problem is it doesn't give me a sense of purpose is the problem. All we're saying is that God created the world. It doesn't give me a sense of what I should do, because actually if God is benign and omnipotent and omniscient and omnipresent, then you talked about plate tectonics. And you said that the part of the beauty of the world is the plate tectonics, the volcanoes and the continents and all of that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But it comes with untold death and destruction and devastation.
It doesn't
sound like a
well,
wonderful
place to be. Well, we have to wrestle with that. I mean, I there's a book, believe it or not, I have a book or two. There's one about who is to blame, God and natural disasters, that came out a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. And he's interesting because he talks about, he compares the death toll from natural disasters historically and today. And he talks a lot about how actually human activity often makes it worse. I mean, for me, Hurricane Katrina is a classic example. I mean, Hurricane Katrina arguably was as powerful as it was because of the impact of climate change, and so hurricanes are getting more violent and more frequent and all of that. But then the levees, the dams in New Orleans, had not been repaired because the US military was too busy in Iraq to do it, which they normally would have done. And then when they said people should get out, they said just get in your car and leave the city. And of course the poor people hadn't got cars, so they couldn't. And then there was looting and all of that. And I just think, I mean, there's a really good example of Bangladesh had a huge cyclone 20, 30 years ago where hundreds of thousands were killed. And then there was another cyclone about 5 years ago, much more intense, but less than 1,000 people were killed because they built houses on stilts and refuges for people to go. So it's a very complex issue, actually, the whole thing of, and I think as Christians we have to wrestle with it, because it's all very well to say to look at a beautiful sunset and a beautiful mountains and all of that without realizing that actually connected to that are earthquakes and volcanoes, and earthquakes and volcanoes are essential for life to be present on the earth because of the carbon cycle. So Ian Stewart, geologist, did a wonderful program about earth and fire and stuff, which I got the DVD for, about the processes in nature and how civilization began near volcanoes because of the fertility of the earth and the prevalence of minerals and so on. So we're intimately connected to the earth. So yes, there's big questions there. I still come back actually to that's how much God wants us to know about how we got here, and that's how much he wants us to know about having a relationship with. And at the end of the day, have a look at Jesus, I think, is all I'd say, because I'll say a bit about this tomorrow, actually. Yes, there's the greatness of God in creation, but there's even more the greatness of God shown in the love, mercy and compassion of Jesus. And that's where See, I'm not sure you can totally explain love by survival. I would like to think that if you've heard my daughter playing the violin, there's something beautiful going on there. That why do we need to do that? I mean, some of the stuff I've been reading says, why do we need to do maths? You don't need maths to survive. We don't, but we search for beauty. So there's something important in that, I think. Why do we search for beauty? I think I'd want to say, one of the areas I find really interesting when I'm reading some of this stuff is the discussion about why are physicists looking for beautiful solutions? Why are the solutions beautiful? And there's something about that that's very profound. We don't, from a human point of view, know the answers to that. But I think we should be searching for the answers to that. Why does beauty matter? You know, I think there's something in there that is a place to explore. I think it's time for coffee. Or one more. Yep.
The issue of suffering, which has been mentioned, and some of the chaos, some natural features, has occupied believers, certainly since the book of Job and the book of Psalms, so 3,000 plus years.
Yeah.
There are no simple answers. Plantinga has, I think, given some answers from a theological viewpoint. You've got him there, have you?
No, I've got something else I'll mention. Right.
But the fact that you find some part of a belief structure difficult does not invalidate it.
Yeah.
Now, by training, I'm a physicist. By career, I'm part engineer, part science teacher. I happen to find quantum entanglement, Schrödinger's cat, and the idea that an electron that has mass and charge can be diffracted, in other words, go through two slits at once. I find that totally revolting, but the evidence forces me to believe these concepts. Science says they are demonstrable, and yeah. I therefore have to accept them whether I like them or not. Yeah. Now, the scientific methods very often says, look for a pattern, look for repeated things that fit together to point to a truth. You look at the universe, you look at life, and it all points to a purposeful creator. Fred Hoyle, who I believe at least initially was an atheist, worked out that the sun could only work if there was a resonance in the carbon atom at a precise value.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone said, there ain't no such resonance. Yeah, yeah. And then they looked and it was there. And Hoyle came round and said, someone's been monkeying with the physics. And that's not just any old someone, that's someone with a capital S.
Yeah.
I carry 20 digits with me, 1 to 20. If you drop those at random, you will have to drop them 10 to the 18 times to be certain that they will fall in numerical order. And if they were instead base pairs and they vibrated 1,000 times a second, they would have to do so 100 million times just to get 20 base pairs in order. That would encode for one small polypeptide with 6 amino acids in it. Even the simplest cell had thousands of those. How long, by chance, would it have taken? Longer than the universe, I believe.
There are ways people try to get around that, obviously. A book I would recommend is Tom McLeish, Faith and Wisdom in Science. And he says, we make a mistake sometimes by starting from Genesis 1. He starts from the end of Job, because at the end of Job, God speaks from the whirlwind. And Job is wrestling with the fact of what appears to be chaotic elements within the natural order. And I do heartily recommend that one. Tom McLeish, Faith and Wisdom in Science. He was another conference I was at was at Durham 3 or 4 weeks ago, when a wonderful organization called Equipping Christian Leaders in an Age of Science had a conference on artificial intelligence and robotics. And that was fascinating. And what I liked about Tom McLeish was he said, we should not see science as a problem. We should see science as a gift. And I like that. I think that's really helpful. So Tom McLeish, Faith and Wisdom in Science, really, really good book. And he deals with the place of chaos in the creation. He deals with how Job is part of the book of Job. He finds with his scientific friends the best place for them to start reading the Bible is the book of Job, actually. Right, have we got refreshments, haven't I? Okay. Do have a look at my books. And then if you want to buy my little book. My little book is an introduction to this stuff, and it's very much on the lines of what we've been doing. So do have a... It's only £3. I can sign it if you want. So when you put it on eBay, you might get more for it.